right, I haven't got much money, but I have to pay more than the rich person?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Mobilize podcast. I'm David Lytle. Let's jump into it. Today, we're talking about debt and debt justice, or really, how we talk about it. Almost everyone's been in debt, but have you ever owed $100 trillion? That's how much global public debt surpassed in 2024. Nearly every country is in debt, but some of us are drowning and have a boot on our heads keeping us under. You've probably heard about Africa's debt crisis. You definitely have heard our own finance minister tell us each year to tighten your belts by cutting unnecessary spending, like teachers and doctors, or worse, to take on new loans just to help repay old ones. The system feels rigged, closer to something created by a loan shark, not simply a banker. That's why many activists call for debt justice to overhaul the system. But how do we build support for this idea? To answer that, we're joined by Liz Caligari, co-founder of Black Sands, Twan van der Tocht, Associate Director of Stack Data Strategy, and Khalil Moses, Senior Campaigner for Public Finance at 350.org. We'll explore new findings from Money Talks, a project by Black Sands and Stack, asking what people really think about debt and what these insights might mean for activists in South Africa. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast today, the Mobilize podcast today. I'd like to start by inviting you all just to share a little bit about yourselves, maybe some of the work you've done and how it relates to this, or your thoughts about the Money Talk series you've worked on. And it'd be great to start with you, Liz. Please go ahead.
So my name's Liz Caligari. I'm co-founder for Black Sands Communications. And I work with all sorts of different clients, maybe mainly NGOs, who are working on different issues, lots of different issues. So, you know, there might be like freshwater species or poverty or vaccines or renewable energy. And one of the reasons Money Talks exists is because the thing that really brings everyone together is, how do you fund it? Where do you get the money from? And how do you persuade people to give you money for all these issues? So that's kind of how we got into this. It's kind of seeing what draws all these issues together.
That last part in particular, right? How do you make people to, how do you convince people that this is what we need to do, or this is where we need to spend our money, or this is where we need to get money from?
And it's getting harder and harder, right? Because basically, how do you persuade people when to spend money on anything that isn't a major domestic and immediate concern in the world right now?
Yeah.
That's really hard.
Particularly when you feel like you don't have any. With that said, Khalil, would you like to go ahead and let us know a little bit about you?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Khalil Moses. I am in South Africa, based in South Africa, Cape Town, and I work for an organization called 350.org. We're a climate justice organization that operates on every continent on planet Earth, fighting against fossil fuel corporations and pushing for a just energy transition and a renewable energy revolution. So moving away from toxic polluting industries that exploit workers to instead renewable energy production that is owned by and uplifts not just rich multinational corporations, but also the workers who drive these industries. I am the public finance campaigner at 350. That means my work has been focused around pushing for greater awareness around what climate justice means, yes, but how finance is involved, how important it is for a justice-centered approach to finance. So we've done work called the Fair Finance School, which brings together young climate justice activists around the African continent to really discuss how climate finance relates to their work, how best to campaign against development finance institutions, to campaign for greater investment in renewable energy projects rather than fossil fuel industries.
Cool. So like kind of the real coalface, excuse the pun, of how we actually make an energy transition real. On the side, when we were doing a bit of sleuthing about you before in preparation for today, we saw that you have a particular interest in, is it liminal photography?
Yeah. So I'm on the side. Architectural and street photographer.
So yeah, it sounds a bit like the way your activism is falling, the transition is actually similar to sort of your sort of artistic background in a sense.
Yeah, I think it's
Cool.
my work, both from the creative side and the activist side, I think is all about the built environment and how we can make it work for people.
Yeah, the transition, the change, the how we change these spaces. Tuan, do you want to go ahead and let us know a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. Thanks, David. So I'm an associate director at Stack Data Strategy. So we're a public opinion analytics firm based in London, the UK. Myself, I'm based in The Hague in the Netherlands. I'm really just interested in all kinds of public opinion research, but mostly, and personally, I would say, interested in the types of big political trends that shape public views on the one hand, and also, I guess, more on the campaign side, but on those rare occasions when public views also have the chance to shape these big political trends, I think are particularly interested to me.
It's really fascinating, I think, a lot of the work you guys are doing. In particular, I'm wondering how does data fit into changing hearts and minds, right? Because I think a lot of the time, facts are not actually that compelling. But this work that you've done with Black Sands is about what are compelling facts. So what is sort of your theory of how you actually bring facts into these conversations and make them compelling rather than just something that people don't listen to at all or don't get interested in?
I think that's a really interesting tension. And the tension exists specifically for campaigners who want views to change as well, because the thing we're measuring is always the current situation, so how things are now. I think with kind of very, very much future focused campaigners like Khalil, obviously this is not the end point where you want public opinion to be in 10, 20 years. So how do you bridge that gap, I think is a really interesting question. I mean, on the fact side of things, we try and be as transparent as we can be about things like methodology, data collection, measurement, so that, you know, even if there are different conceptions of how you should measure a thing, at least we can have a shared conversation about how we measure it. I think hopefully that brings a little bit of robustness to the things that we say rather than just us saying numbers.
So you give us the facts, and then Khalil, myself, and Liz go and take those facts and change the world with them. Or at least that's the plan, right?
That's the plan.
Which I think segues really well into Liz. This is not the first Money Talks research or the first publishing you guys have done on this. Do you want to just give us a quick outline of what is Money Talks? How long has it been going for? What's it done and what's it doing?
So we started in 2022, we worked with Stack since 2022 on all of the Money Talks research as well. And we started with the question of how do you win support for investment in climate, nature and development? And what we wanted to know was what actually works. So you've just been talking about facts and data, but actually we want to know how you talk about things to win support, which is slightly different. And as I say, we work with lots of different people from purpose-based organizations. And there is a bit of a tendency for people in these organizations to say what they think is the right thing to happen, and not necessarily think about the people they're talking to and how that's going to be responded. And you tend to get lots of campaigners and lots of activists who think in a certain way. And that's great if you're speaking to other people that are like that. However, as we can see in many parts of the world, we need to think about that sort of more centre-ground mainstream people who maybe do care about climate, nature and development, but they're not really engaged because they're just busy dealing with all the crap in their lives, frankly. You know, how to get the kids to school and that mum's ill and I don't know, I've got to take the dog to the vet. Or I can't feed my family. Or, you know, really, really big issues for them in their lives. So they're not they don't care. They've just got other stuff going on. So how do you actually communicate with them? And it goes back to what you were saying that, you know, if science was enough, we wouldn't be in the place we are in right now, right? If people listen to the science. So as important as it is to be evidence-based and science-based, I believe that is important. It's not going to change the world on its own. You need storytelling, you need conversation, you need to be able to communicate. So Money Talk started back in 22, and we originally started looking at research for the G7. And looking at all these issues. Then the next year we were able to expand 15 countries. That's where we did South Africa for the first time, Kenya.
I think that's
Brazil.
When we first met, right?
That is exactly where we first met. Gosh, that must have been back in 23. There you go.
Been a minute.
And then in 2024, we took a deep dive into tax. So how do you communicate a tax to win support? Because that's obviously one of the key methods for raising money to fund all this stuff. And then this year, and this is what we're talking about today, we've taken a deep dive into debt and how to communicate debt.
It's really kind of, I really enjoy the sort of the evolution of it, right? Because it's effectively realizing that these things connect to each other in a sense, right? Is that when you talk about tax, you are talking about debt. Debt is a tax on people in the future sort of idea. I'm sure we're going to dive into that a bit later, maybe. But it's that sort of expanding the scope, expanding what people understand. And I'm really curious about some of the work you've done before this Money Talks work as well. I'm aware that you worked on one of the some Planet Earth documentaries with David Attenborough. That Black Sands was involved in some of that. And something that really comes to mind about that is obviously everything's factually correct. But a lot of focus about how things are positioned, like what is the cause of our ecological disaster? Is it too many people? Is it the way too many people consume and how you communicate that? How does that sort of influence in terms of the Money Talks work you guys do? Or is that really a core foundation of why? Because it helps define how you need to say these things in communications materials.
So not quite sure whether this is answering your question. So come back to me if I don't answer your question. So we worked on... Prior to Black Sands, I worked at WWF, World yes. Wildlife Fund, and that was working on the Our Planet, David Attenborough Netflix documentary and
Our
film.
Planet, sorry.
Yeah. So I kind of harnessed my inner David Attenborough for 3 years, really understanding how he communicates. And he is fact and evidence-based, right? That's what he does. But... my God, does he tell an amazing story in an amazing way. I mean, I've seen him at an event where you had all these people who I knew who are all brilliant speakers. And then David got on stage and started talking. And it was like a whole different sort of engagement performance. And he's always, true to what he believes and what he wants to portray. He has a sense of public service and public broadcast, that old-fashioned BBC background. You know, this is a public need, public education. And I think all of that sort of very much influenced the thinking that is, you know, to really engage people, you've got to tell stories. But one of the problems with documentary and natural history documentary was, for years, you've had all these amazing documentaries going, look, nature, it's out there thriving and beautiful and wonderful. Mm, you know, there wasn't any jeopardy or threat. So Our Planet, the producers and directors and Sir David Attenborough, you know, deliberately set out in Our Planet to talk about the problems alongside the beauty and the wonder. And that was a difficult and ongoing conversation about how you get that balance between inspiring and jeopardy, right? Because it's very easy to just say it's all shit, it's all, we're losing everything, nature's screwed. And then do you engage people? Where do you get action from that? So I guess all of that sort of background definitely came into thinking about Money Talks and the importance of how we communicate.
Yeah, it really comes through because it is that acknowledgement of it's also, you don't just want to share understanding, you want to draw someone into action. You want to make people, like you were saying, that thing about, you don't just want this sort of view of, oh no, everything's lost, it's the end of the world, everything's terrible. It's no, something's not right, but collectively we can work on it sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, so, fundamentally, why are you communicating? Because you want an action of some sort.
Theory of change, the favorite thing anyone who's ever written a fundraising proposal would know. And I think that's, talking about that gap in understanding of knowledge, I think, Tuan, that leads me to sort of a question I want to ask you, which is, why debt specifically? What is the specific thing about debt in isolation that makes us want to talk about it, or why we should be talking about it or changing our minds on it?
Yeah, I think that is one of those topics that's always been a part of kind of international policy debates, but you rarely really hear how anyone thinks about this. I was just kind of or how ordinary citizens think about it, basically. I was looking this up before, and whenever you look at other survey projects that have looked into this, you're always looking at how citizens think about debt as a national issue, if at all, right? This type of survey research is relatively rare to begin with, but even then it stays within the domestic. I think what's really special here is that we're looking at this as an international policy problem not in the technical way that the IMF might talk about it or that governments might talk about it, but in a way that really connects to people. I think that there's quite a gap there that I was quite excited to explore.
Okay. So there's two elements to it that I'm getting from you, right? So one is that this is a bigger focus. It's understanding that debt is part of an international ecosystem as opposed to just a household debt or a national debt. But then the other one is how it affects people. So connecting the dots between what this debt that maybe was accumulated 50 years ago in some of the unjust debt we talk about, how it's affecting people's lives, people born today, and that sort of thing. Which I don't want to throw this over to you, Khalil, because with the debt justice work, that's entirely about looking at how this debt was accumulated, what the debt is actually doing. Do you want to sort of expand for me, what is the context of debt specifically in relation to the climate crisis? Like, how is it in some ways causing the climate crisis, or isn't it causing the climate crisis? Or how is it or isn't it causing poverty or a lack of development? Can you give me some sort of thoughts from the work you guys are doing?
Yeah, sure. I think to try and understand the context of debt, particularly debt in the global south, one has to understand the context of centuries of dispossession and exploitation by the global north, where largely global north countries in Europe and the US have grown wealthy by extracting resources from the global south, exploiting the working class, and intentionally hampering the development of the global south. So they've helped, in some cases, they've helped our nations develop only insofar as to generate profit for themselves, and rather than helping us build self-reliance and self-determination. What this unjust system has really left us with is a circumstance where the global south is filled with countries like South Africa, which are resource-based economies, completely reliant on borrowing money from the same countries who've been extracting their resources for centuries. What this means is there's an extreme wealth divide that keeps growing, and there's been very little change from the days of colonies, banana republics, oil and coal republics. So that's the kind of context that we're living in, and how debt is exacerbating this problem is, like I mentioned, many global south countries are reliant on debt in order to develop. But what we've been seeing is global north countries tend to borrow to African countries, particularly in Asian countries, at higher interest rates than they would to themselves. So, for example, Germany would borrow to the UK at an interest. I'm just using random figures. These aren't necessarily
don't quote Khalil on this.
Factual. Yeah. Don't quote me on these particular figures. I'm just using it as an example to generalize. But Germany, for example, would borrow to France or the Netherlands at an interest rate of 5%. Comparatively, they would borrow to South Africa or Indonesia at an interest rate of 15 to 20%. So already we're fighting a losing battle. The second thing is how that affects climate and our transition from fossil fuel dependence to renewable energy in a just and sustainable way is often the money that's being given to global south countries to build renewable energy renewable energy power plants and renewable energy generation is also given as loans. So the way the climate finance system works is global north countries tend to give money to global south countries in the form of loans, even when it comes to the renewable energy transition. So countries that have been historically underdeveloped for hundreds of years, exploited and extracted from, are being shouldered with debt burdens, even when we're facing this existential threat of a climate crisis affecting everybody, which is an incredibly dangerous and dire circumstance.
And unjust, right? Like, I think what's interesting is in the South African context, we have this JET IP, which is effectively a lot of global north nations lending money to South Africa to go from a fossil fuel intensive economy to a non-fossil fuel intensive economy. But also in some cases, it's very prescriptive, right? I know with a lot of the some of the loans are like, no, they want us to develop green hydrogen to export to Europe. But then they won't promise that they'll buy it at a price which is affordable for South Africa. But we won't get the money unless we agree to do that. And I think this is like kind of the complexity of debt. And that debt can be powerful in the sense that we build a dam, which, you know, secures water supply for the foreseeable future, and we pay it off over 30 years, and everyone lives better, and we build a better economy because of the dam and the water it's providing or the energy it's providing. But at the same time, let's say we incur a lot of debt to hire foreign consultants based in Europe or America to tell us how we need to build a hydrogen infrastructure in South Africa, and half the money is actually spent on foreign services actually rather than building the local economy. So it's that sort of it's complexity of it. I think
Yeah, I mean,
this leads.
there are even, sorry to cut you off there, David. There's even some circumstances where debt was given to, for example, South Africa, when it really shouldn't have. So to build our coal-fired power plant, Medupi, which is one of the largest in the world, an incredibly destructive and harmful, not just to the environment and our ability to detransition and decarbonize as an economy, but also the communities and the entire province surrounding the power plant. That money was given by the IMF and the World Bank in the form of a $2 billion US dollar loan that was supposedly given to help us transition from a fossil fuel dependent economy to a renewable energy powered economy, under the guise that we would use something called clean coal. I don't know what clean coal is. Every time I've
Don't they
seen
scrub
coal,
it or
it's been
something?
incredibly dirty. Yeah, they must scrub it clean, right? And that's how it becomes non-polluting. So they gave us this debt under the guise that we would use clean coal in the Medupi-fired power plant, and that's why the money would go towards it. So even in circumstances where the money is supposedly being given to help us build renewable energy generation, it the pretenses behind it are false. But we remain burdened with that $2 billion debt.
Liz, I'm getting the sense that you really want to say something about this. I'm getting
I would just
that distinctive sense from you.
I'm just going to look this up, just coming back on the interest rates. Khalil was talking about how they are so different depending which country you're on. But I'm just saying the research shows that, I mean, there was huge, I can't remember the exact figure to remember, it was like 80% or something, that people say that poorer countries should have the same or lower interest rates than richer countries. You know, there is huge support for that. And the other thing is, there is a huge support for people actually getting better loans when they're dealing with climate action, disasters, adaptation, so forth. I can't remember the exact wording. So that was one of the sort of things where we're tied up in the policy side of it. But when you just ask everyday people what they think, they're like, well, yeah, well, you know, and
That
that's
makes
why I think
sense.
people can relate it to their own experience because. You know, although it's different from personal debt, it's still that thing of, right, I haven't got much money, but I have to pay more than the rich person. You know,
Well,
it's.
I think what's What's really fascinating with that, and this is a rabbit hole we could spend days going down, is ostensibly, right, the reason why debt is more expensive for a global South country is, oh, well, there's higher risk. But effectively, a lot of those debts are secured by military might, in a sense, right? Is that if a country is going to start, if we look at developing countries, particularly in West Africa, where if they start getting into a position where they're not going to succeed on repaying the repayment terms, they may renegotiate the loan contracts or deals. But on the other side of it is effectively there's a powerful state in the global north often saying, well, you know, we'll cut off this other thing that you need, not necessarily militarily, but with some sort of use of force. So it's almost a question of like, is this really the right risk matrix that we're using? I'm to understand. Tuan, I know you're sort of like probably the most data-y person here. Do you have some of those, you know, the sort of, I know this research didn't look into the nation state sort of idea, but I don't know if you have a sense of the degrees of difference with how interest rates and how debt is perceived on the global south or by the global north on the global south, and the difference between that and the global and how it's perceived in the global north. Or how it's the risk of debt is perceived in the global north.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the risk itself, we didn't test, or we don't have a variable to specifically measure that. But I think, yeah, as Liz mentioned earlier, there's overwhelmingly the feeling that that this feels unfair. That you know, we don't take within the context of the survey research, we don't take respondents through the entire debt policy debate, but we show them certain outcomes, and they and the clear reaction to that is it doesn't make sense for this group of countries to pay more than that other group of countries. So in a way, there are certain parts of this process where the outcomes don't seem to be matching the purpose anymore, and that I think is very clear even to people with, you know, who aren't steeped in the technical expertise that you might need for some of these parts of the policy issue.
That's really fascinating that you talk about that. It's the disconnect between perception and the like what people would want and what reality is. And I think this actually speaks to a bit about the global north versus global south relationship, is that the practical relationship issues are on how nation states interact with each other, right? Where, you know, say Liz from coming from a British taxpayer base, or you coming from a Netherlands taxpayer base. The country that you are ostensibly part of is not necessarily doing what you want it to do. In fact, it's not ostensibly doing what the majority of your population in the country you're in wants you to do, which I imagine makes it a bit awkward, because you have South African-based activists or South African activists like myself and Khalil, and we'll be like, you terrible imperial agents from the global north, and you're part of the benefiting from our suffering in the global south, et cetera, et cetera. But... ahead, Liz.
I was just going to say, yeah, no, I mean, that's something that I find just so... I speak to colleagues in South Africa and other countries, and I feel the anger.
Awkward.
And I'm kind of with you, the social justice and the climate justice. But then last year, Tuan and I tested concepts of climate justice. And like in a country like South Africa, people understand it and they get it and they support it. In a country like the UK, it's like, what's that? Is that taking people to court? I mean, people just no idea. And so you can't come to the UK and say you're a rich country to normal people. So you
of
should
course,
be paying.
Because you don't feel that way.
People feel rich. So it doesn't work.
Well, I think there's also a rich country does not mean all the people in it are rich. And
The rich countries have gotten really good at not just exploiting the working class in the global south, but exploiting the working class back home too, right? It's tried and true practices that were tested in their own borders before it was exported across the world. So, of course, it is really difficult to really understand the wealth and power that one's country can have when you don't always feel it as an individual citizen.
What I really love about where this conversation's going now is different There's some solidarity globally around this, right? There's an alignment of the outcomes we want are actually often quite the same. We want to be able to live our lives without, like, under the threat of annihilation constantly, be it economic or otherwise. We want to live in a world where our environment isn't constantly at threat and things are changing in ways we can't handle. But the way we communicate is very different. So in South Africa, it's easy for us to go, oh, well, look, they're the bad guy. It's easy to go and look north, those bad guys over there. But as people in the global north, you need a very different message to help them understand what their role is, what their role isn't, how they're not necessarily benefiting them on an individual level, like the nation may and the wealthy in a nation may, but individually, they aren't really benefiting that much from the giant global exploitation that's taking place. But they're on board with doing something about it if we talk to them in the right way. Liz, I really want to hand over to you for that, because I know that's like your whole thing with This Money Talks.
Yeah. So trying to make those connections, I think, is really important. And what we found, I mean, Twan can probably talk to some of the focus groups we've done, because that's fascinating, because you start with something like debt and people don't understand it. They don't know much about it. The awareness is, you know, not strong, or tax or whatever we've tested. But once you start unpacking it, people get it. You know, they're not daft quite often. They're just, you know, they're coming from their reality, but they sort of get it, and people can make the connections. So the number one concern in countries like the UK and the US is cost of living. Why is the cost of living going up? And you have to tell that story to energy, to food. The other concern is, you know, security, economic stability. So one of the things that we really need to do as a movement is be stronger, particularly in sort of global north countries, is to tell that story of why you and your everyday life is connected to that bigger picture. And people do get it. It's not easy, though, because it's such a crowded space. You know, everyone's so bombarded with so much communication and everything all of the time. But if you can find some time and space with someone and actually have a conversation that starts with what they care about, then you can get somewhere. But what people in care about first in South Africa is possibly different. So, you know, for example, if you ask people what they think the biggest global issue is across all the countries we survey, climate change comes top. But there's three countries where it didn't make the top three, and South Africa is one of them. That doesn't mean, but when you look at the data, actually, South Africans probably care about climate change more than people in the US. But it's just, you know, they're really, it's jobs, corruption. You know, the domestic reality of what they're dealing with comes first.
I have so many follow-ups I want to ask there, but I feel like I want to actually start with the beginning thing, which was you were saying about the methodology of this. So I think often when research is conducted on these sort of things and sentiments, particularly from a Global North institution studying South Africa, there's often a question of, like, how credible is that research? Did you actually go and talk with, because South Africa is a very stratified society where you have myself and Khalil, which are, you know, middle class to upper class individuals by kind of traditional standards. We have access to the internet. We can do cool podcasts. The majority of South Africans don't have access to even listening to the media we're creating. So what is the methodology? How did you guys actually conduct this research, specifically in South Africa, but also more broadly?
Yeah, so...
That's a good one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I had assumed that. so we surveyed, I think, just over 15,000 people in total across 10 countries using online interviews. So it is all online. That's an important part of that kind of research methodology. And then we also ran focus groups in the UK, the US, and South Africa. So the idea there is we're combining that quantitative setup via online surveys to give us a really good comparable data set to map the same variables, the same answers to survey questions across our mix of countries. And then combining that with kind of the depth that these conversations with real people in a room, you know, as focus groups do, the depth that gives you and the extra insight that brings. So I think, yeah, interesting thing that you're saying about the kind of stratified nature of South African society in a way. So the way quantitative research would try and deal with that is use quotas, which is a technical term for essentially just saying we need to make sure that within relevant groups or on relevant demographic variables, we've got a distribution of the population. So whether it comes to kind of income or different age groups or different educational groups with different levels of educational attainment, we need to make sure our sample overall is balanced. So it's been our approach throughout, but also in South Africa, it's particularly relevant, I would say.
But in South Africa, really we actually did an extra focus group, didn't we? Partly to try and address that issue. So because we were working with South African partners who were kind of raising exactly the point that you raised, David. And it's not perfect. You can't go out to people who are in a very rural community and get them. It is an online poll, but for the focus groups, we did actually deliberately do an extra one to try and capture more upfront in the quoll. I can't remember the exact definition of the three groups, Twan. I don't know if you can.
So the definitions were based on the LSM measures. So what you're getting is kind of catch-all metric for socioeconomic opportunity or wealth, or however you want to frame that, and we made sure that we stratified that measure into three groups that speak to different levels of that measure.
And for our listeners, LSM is a sort of a marketing tool used to identify different sort of wealth or categories of consumers. I'm sure we can put a link somewhere in the description to let everyone know what that is. But I'm really glad to hear you did that. And if I recall correctly, you guys work with New Economy Hub on that in South Africa. Were they your main partner here?
Yes. That was exactly that. So, it was Sekwudlani who were kind of, we actually had a sort of robust conversation about how we spent the budget. And they were like, I think this is, we really need to do this. So that we started doing that. So we've done it.
It's good to see, right? What's really good to see about it is it brings a lot of credibility to the data, because I think otherwise, if you just do the, budget restrictions say, oh, we can only do the online survey, that might give you a good sense in a global north country where 95% of your population are comfortable using or have the data, device, and comfort to engage with an English language survey. In a country like South Africa, where the most dominant language is only like 20, 30% of the population, and you have that, once again, basically developed world lifestyles of some people and very much the opposite for others. I think it brings a lot of credibility. And with that in mind, and I suppose that mostly at Liz and Twan, but I think Khalil, I'm comfortable to come in on this as well, is what are like two key takeaways from this research, this specifically the debt research that you guys have just done that you sort of want to share or that you'd want to highlight?
Shall I go first? It'll be interesting if we say this. Do I have to only pick two?
Yes. We only have so much time, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
We always send people to read all the research. We'll link it so they can get the access to the whole thing.
And there will be a full webinar just on South Africa for those who are interested.
There we go.
I think one thing is people in all these different countries are actually surprisingly similar. So on perceptions of debt. So what South Africa shared with the UK and US and the focus groups was that actually people don't understand it because they don't really know much about it. They think about it domestically. And everyone actually has there's a fairly dominant view that, if you borrowed the money, you should pay it back. That's kind of where if people relate it to that, if my kid borrowed lots of money from me, I'd expect them to pay it back. And people relate it to it like that. And that's actually common across different countries. And then the other one is that talking about mutual benefit works. So debt campaigners have been very good in the past about talking about fairness and making the moral case. And we should still do that. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that. But the mutual benefit, which is kind of the point we were making earlier about linking people, is kind of like, well, if people aren't dealing with debt, then they can grow and they can trade and there's less need for aid. That kind of framing worked really, really well across lots of different demographics. And actually, the three countries where it increased support most were South Africa, Kenya, and the USA. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah. It's definitely an odd group, right? Like South Africa, Kenya, came on the same page. USA, wait, what?
Well, I think it's partly because one of the words we said was, I think in the current conversation there was several, I'll look it up and I'll read it out in a sec, but it was roughly speaking, you can grow, trade, and reduce the need for aid in the future. So I think you know, the US, that's obviously a big conversation there. They want to stop giving people aid around the world. But actually, South Africans, they want to, you know, have a bit of agency. And, you know, they don't want the aid either. They want a fair deal. So there's something in there that actually everyone agrees on.
Hmm, a fair deal. Tuan, Khalil, anything from your side?
Yeah, I can add one quick thing. I think for me, the most striking finding is that prioritization is really the challenge, and it's less about persuasion maybe on some of the largest parts of this issue. So my own background is in political science. We look at issues in terms of salience and in terms of position. So those are two separate concepts. Salience, just how important something is to people, and position being what they actually think about it. As Liz said, what they actually think about it when it comes to debt is relatively similar across a lot of different citizens across different countries. But how salient the issue actually is what really differs. So you need to make those connections, and that makes communication really important. But the real battle is not as much about persuasion, but it's about getting the issue of debt to the top of the agenda. And I think, in a way, I'd expected both of those dimensions to be a real kind of uphill battle. So perhaps it's even kind of an optimistic takeaway that it's just one. Obviously, that's still a huge effort, but maybe that's a bit of optimism there.
Anything from you, Khalil?
Yeah, I think something that really stood out to me was hearing the sense of solidarity, or rather the solidarity that could possibly be built between people in the Global South and the Global North, and start to address that divide in that some of the framings around debt and the sense around fairness on debt is the same. What Liz was mentioning about mutual benefit and mutual aid, that sentiments seem to be the same there. I think that's a very important takeaway to be used in our campaigning work and our communications. And then the second thing is just how valuable this research has been to me in not just understanding that, I think because we're already aware that one of the key problems here is people are intentionally excluded from the economy, or excluded from understanding how the economy works, right? And how debt development financing works. I think we, as activists and researchers and economists, all understand that the crux of the matter really is how do we start to bridge that understanding? And again, going back to the sense of familiarity and the sense of solidarity that can be really relied upon in the way, the similar ways people frame these issues is really important.
It's interesting that sort of that similarness of the world, right, is that you can have people in very radically different economic positions in literally the two different sides of the Global North, Global South conversation, but there's actually, our values are the same, right? People around the world tend to have quite similar values when you come down to it, when you sort of bring it to that level. There was something for me in particular that when I was looking at sort of one of the outputs is, so the question of what are the main reasons why some countries end up with high levels of debt, select up to three. And it was uniform, effectively, in terms of what the top three were, in that it was corruption or misuse of public funds, poor government financial management, and high levels of public spending without enough money coming in, right? So there's this fundamental agreement globally that this is the problem. But something that's noteworthy about that to me is it's all insular looking. It's all, my country is being corrupt. My country is misusing money. My country is this. And there's not really that sort of a fair deal. Everyone's like, yeah, it should be fair. But when they actually have the point to think about what is the problem, they tend to not really think about the global system that's perpetuating these things, right? So I'm curious about how the three of you would respond to that one. Do you think this is, like, is this one of the areas we really need to work at as activists, right? At changing people's understanding of global debt? Liz, you look like you really want to jump at this. Go.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I'm just looking at the, you know, that's particularly the case in South Africa. So corruption and misuse is like, right up there in terms of concerns, even more than in other countries. And It's interesting because people in South Africa had a better understanding of how debt could impact their citizens. It was a little bit less far off in time and space than for someone in the US, for example. But nevertheless, when they say, why is this happening? They're blaming the national government and local corruption. They're not thinking about the system at all. The people just, absolutely. It's something we need to communicate better. But this is a thing. And this is one of the problems with all these different countries, living in the UK, retreating into these nationalist conversations. It's getting harder and harder to, that some of these problems have to be solved by taking a global and systems view. And I think it's really, really hard, but it's one of the communications challenges we've got to tackle, basically.
Mm. Cleo, Twan?
So I think this is one of the biggest gaps in understanding for me. So the fact that people point towards all these factors. Well, we know that in reality, kind of external shocks and all kinds of external drivers are huge things that affect debt as well. But people don't automatically point to those. So I think that's a really important part, in the sense of that's where you need to reframe the conversation. Because if you leave people with that kind of corruption and domestic mismanagement story, then I think it's quite likely that that kind of undermines empathy as well, right? If you think debt is a country's own fault, that leaves you with a different set of attitudes towards what the policy solution is likely to be than if you think, debt is a systemic thing. So I think there's much to be gained there, basically.
Mm. I'm noticing a trend here. It's Liz, Twan, Khalil. Liz, Twan, Khalil. So, Khalil.
I think the two of you captured it quite eloquently, so I won't add anything further other than to quote Che Guevara, who said that the first thing is debt to imperialist banks is unpayable and immoral. And the second thing is our people are not to blame for our underdevelopment or for the debt. That the present social, economic, and political circumstances are really what's to blame. But I think our politicians should still regardless shield, at least in South Africa, some of the blame for corruption, mismanagement, and misappropriation of funds. That is still a critical and really, really challenging issue. But that can only so much can be done when resolving the internal challenges of a nation if we're still being shouldered with enormous amounts of unpayable, immoral debt. By resolving things internally, it won't really change the external circumstances, like Twan mentioned, which are systemic.
I think the sort of flip side of this is what came through really strongly is there was real support for action on debt, debt relief, debt cancellation, if it was linked to things that were outside of a country's control, right? So crises, COVID, economic shocks that are outside of a country's control, conflict, that kind of thing. So the opportunity here for people working in this space is to move the conversation on from corruption, mismanagement, from that internal to the external. And I think that's a really clear opportunity highlighted by the research.
I think now that we're in the second half of the podcast today, we really want to actually jump into what are our takeaways about what we do about this? What do people feel about things like debt relief, debt cancellation? How do they come across in different countries? What are those general perceptions? Liz, I really want to start with you here because you're kind of that person which always looks at that big level or the top level of things. What are the solutions? What are the solutions people are kind of intuitively supportive of that comes from this data, all this research?
So we mentioned one of them earlier, which is things that are outside of a country's control. So if you're talking about things like, severe weather, storms, COVID, then people instinctively support that over other things. And there is support for debt cancellation and debt relief. I think that was one of the surprising things. So, you know, people do aren't necessarily against it, but the idea of debt relief and there being sort of terms and conditions applied was far more palatable to people. And I think that goes back to people's sense of yeah, if you took the money, you should, you know, it's a deal. You should stand by the deal without sort of understanding the wider systemic issues. But I think the other thing is to talk about the tangible positive impact of debt action. So don't talk about climate justice and social justice. Talk about schools and education. Because people, the minute you start talking about schools and education and the fact that people, you know, people are blown away by, is it 48 countries are spending more on servicing debt than on schools and education. People are absolutely blown away by that and they didn't know it. And then as soon as you start talking about actually normal people being able to go to school and nurses, and then people start softening and they support that. So talking about tangible things that benefit ordinary people really helps to win support. I've probably forgotten some. There's some other things as well.
But before you comment, Twana, actually, I really want to go to Khalil here because I think that's a lot of what you do in 350, right? Is you connect the dots between school lunch and an international deal signed 30 years ago around debt that's actually more of a scam than a fair deal. And then I'll come to you, Twana, after that. But Khalil, do you want to sort of give a response to what Liz was saying there in terms of, like, particularly in the South African context and how people understand these bigger issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think relating debt and the debt crisis we're in right back to the economic and cost of living crisis in South Africa is a really good way to translate what is usually quite a mystical, misunderstood thing like the economy or like global debt and relate it to the everyday lived experience and the story of somebody living through this crisis. You know, in South Africa, our working class and middle class is being squeezed. In many cases, families are unable to afford the very basics that it requires to live, while the wealthy own more and more of our homes and our land and grow their profits to record levels. And in this kind of circumstance, what we need now more than ever is greater spending on social services, like Liz was mentioning, like schools, like clinics, like libraries, public transportation, providing people with a basic income grant so they can actually meet their immediate economic needs. But what debt is doing to our politicians is they're forcing them into really difficult decisions. Either they continue to pay rising interest payments and make those bank executives wealthier, or they spend on essential life-saving social services. And more often than not, they choose to service debt payments. They keep choosing the pockets of the IMF and the World Bank over their own people.
That's a interesting. That sort of, I think, is a very understandable position. But Twan, I'm curious, what did the data sort of show, or the research show, in terms of how people in the global north felt about those issues in the global south? Right? Is there an insight into that? Are they like, for example, is it, I want our government to consider doing a deal regarding debt relief of some sort so that people in South Africa that currently aren't getting, you know, basic amenities or basic services get those basic services? Or is it a bit of a different sort of thinking for why they're interested in debt relief in the South? Is there a more personal to them reason? The one that comes to mind for me is, do people kind of connect it to the idea of immigration, or which seems to be quite a big concern in the global north? Yeah, I wondered if you could give some insight to that, Twan.
Yeah, so we tested a number of different kind of messaging frames around these kinds of things. So what we did concretely in the research, if we would split the sample into, you know, three or four, depending on the test, randomly selected groups that were then each shown a different kind of message prompt. So this is A/B testing in the kind of marketing research world, or a survey experiment if you're more on the academic side. It's a good way to test whether or not these kinds of messages really make a difference. Like, as you say, do people care about one over the other? I think we're seeing that it differs very much by country, but on average, this what Liz earlier called the kind of mutual benefit framing is what drives a lot of the message home. So whenever you can connect it to concrete things that emphasize, again, mutual benefit, that's great. And why we think that helps maybe over messages around fairness or injustice on the larger scale, and specifically on the political right, which I think was an interesting angle, is because it helps cut through the cynicism. So it shows people that maybe otherwise wouldn't think globally about these issues, that there are very concrete, albeit sometimes small, gains to be had mutually, rather than this being something that's done exclusively from kind of altruistic motives, which is, I think, the way in which much of kind of left-wing politics has been talking about this historically. But if the mission is to appeal to a broader audience across the political aisle, then perhaps that's why the mutual benefit frame on average is getting those kinds of returns in our testing, at least.
And there's one other frame we tested that I just want to mention, which was called the common enemy frame, which I, you know, as a campaigner, maybe a bit more steeped in what's going on in this, I thought was going to be really popular. So big banks and investors, you know, they need to stop profiting from debt. And I thought, yeah, that would be really popular. It was actually least popular. And what's interesting in the focus groups, I mean, it was popular in places. I'm not saying it wasn't, you know, there was no support for it, but in the focus groups, there was a lot in South Africa and in countries like the US. It was like, oh, they're businesses. They're doing what businesses do. I was like, oh.
That's a really interesting dynamic. It's one of the things that activists that work in a US and South African environment often talk about is that they're obviously very different countries. But they both countries have like this idea that there's nothing that you are supposed to go out there and do well. It's often talked about in like corruption in South Africa. Oh, well, it's this comrade's turn to eat, or this person's turn to eat. And the sort of idea is we shouldn't begrudge people that do well. Albeit we are upset when they do well at the expense of others, I think. But maybe we don't always do a good job of recognizing that. And maybe that's maybe one of the differences is that there needs to be a recognition that actually the reason this person is doing well is not just because they make good decisions. It's because they've done things that are harmful to people. I don't know, and I'm interested in diving into that a little bit. So that sense that people are more interested maybe in the positive framing rather than the negative framing is what I'm hearing. But also, what works then? Like, what is the mutual beneficial argument? So what is the mutual benefit for the UK looking at restructuring the debt with South Africa so that there's no interest or very low interest, that there's like a 10-year moratorium or whatever? What are the benefits to these for the UK that can sell the argument? And what is the benefit to South Africans? How do we make this mutual beneficial argument between two nations that are in radically different positions?
Well, I think that's where we need a lot more experimentation, a lot more testing, and a lot more real life comms, actually, because, you know, what we do with Stack is, you know, Stack Google is brilliant insight. But as we know, comms isn't just about words. It's also about messenger, platform, creative.
Yeah.
And everything in Money Talks is really a sort of some pointers and direction of travel. So we need to sort of really start testing things. And we have been in other work testing various things. So in the UK, for example, we're looking at pandemics as a sort of the mutual benefit argument. So, you know, you can't, if you cut funding programs around the world on various health issues, that's going to come back on the UK in terms of
Ebola or COVID argument.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Another one is economic, just security, actually, overall. So in current world, obviously, a lot of conflict and instability. One of the, obviously, immigration is a really, like, getting to be the most important topic in the UK, and is very important in lots of global north countries. this is a really tricky one to navigate, but fundamentally, people being able to be safe in their own homes and not being forced to migrate is one side of the argument. And then obviously in the UK, people want to stop people coming in. And trying to point out to people that a safe, stable world where people feel safer in their own homes, I don't think we've managed that successfully. And it's such a toxic debate. Somewhere like the UK, it's very, very hard. But that sense of economic stability and trade partners and growth is something that I think we could also do more exploration of.
Khalil, Tuan, do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it sounds like perhaps the argument that resonates best is leaning on this idea of interconnectedness, that we no longer live in a world where a country can isolate itself completely from the goings-on of the rest of the world and the political and economic circumstances of the rest of the world, that your economic reality is directly tied to somebody else's. Your safety or lack of safety is tied to somebody else's. And perhaps creating that sense, or helping build that sense of empathy, really, I mean, in my work, what I've seen is it is often empathy for someone else or another community which gets the argument through, that morality or facts and evidence often can be something that the logical side of us can come to grips with, but really the emotive and the heart behind why people do things is empathy, and having people trying to create an empathy-based response in people, I think is definitely the best way forward.
So kind of global solidarity as opposed to global enemies. Spend more time talking about what connects us than what makes us different from a certain
Without
billionaire.
Using the word solidarity, I think.
Oh, really? Is solidarity problematic?
Again, I've not tested it, but I suspect it's another one of those things like climate justice. In the UK, it sounds a bit like lefty.
Well, you guys have a whole organization there called Solidarity, which is like a political organization, isn't it?
Do we?
In the UK. Isn't it like a supporter of Labour or something? Anyway, I don't know.
Maybe, but anyway, I think solidarity, you know, like a lot of these terms are loaded, and this is one we can test with Stack in the future, I guess, but I suspect solidarity is another one of those things.
Yes, we know what's going in your next research.
Yeah. Solidarity, I suspect, is one of those terms that feels from a sort of more left political spectrum to people in the middle. I don't know that.
It's interesting, and I remember from some of your previous research, the term reparations, which in South Africa is almost required to be used if you're in certain political environments. Like, it's a fundamental part of the conversation in our history is that reparations need to be made. But I know in the global north, it like shuts down a conversation immediately and no one wants to interact in it. Tuan, what's your sort of thoughts on this in terms of the language, in terms of the where we move? How do we build these campaigns? How do we build these collective actions?
Yeah, it's I mean, that's a really big question. I think the differences you highlight between kind of political discourses, especially between kind of global north countries and some global south countries as well, is really important. I think where words like reparations are positioned within that discourse, and the differences between those positions across that divide is crucially why this can appeal to a broad majority in South Africa, especially in certain circles, as you say, but at the moment cannot appeal to a majority support in many global north countries. And I think that's where we need to think carefully about what we're trying to achieve with our communications, again, and what audiences we're speaking to. But whenever that audience is general and national, this kind of extra level of attention to words that in and of themselves won't cause or will bring audiences together in a way. You want that message to get across. And I think what we're seeing is that a lot of that kind of pragmatic discourse is what tends to be not only kind of non-offensive, but also constructive in a way. And I think that constructiveness is what people find easier to latch onto. Now, of course, there is value to a lot of these words like climate justice, especially in South Africa, for example, if they're more commonly used terms. But be careful when the audience is actually international, and think about what audiences we're reaching here and what the implications are of some words.
The thing that brings up for me, it's sort of segues very naturally into the next section, is that I think a lot of this conversation is about audiences. And I think we've got like a risk here where on one level, we don't want to overly segment our audiences because we can't, right? We can't go and say, because, you know, at the best level, you can have everyone be their own audience, but we can't really do 60 million different messages, right? In the case of like the South African population or the equivalents for other countries. So what is sort of the approach you would recommend, or what is the approach that you're seeing from this? Is what are the ways that you segment the audience? How many different audiences do you segment? What should or shouldn't we do? Like, we don't want to talk to everyone with one message because that's impossible, but we also don't want to talk to too few. Yeah, and I'm not going to throw it at anyone specifically. I'm just curious to sort of see from the room, what is sort of the top response on that?
Well, I think about it in the two key audiences for organizations and NGOs working in this space. So one is the base, the people who support you, the people who really care, who are really engaged. In the stack talk called the global anxious. And they tend to be the people who support charity. And with it, they're actually like activists, they're a subsection of that. They're politically aware, they probably know who they're going to vote for already. And they're really important. You know, they're really important. They tend to be noisier and support all of the things that are going on. But the other really important audience is that persuadable audience we sort of mentioned earlier. So people who do want climate action, or do think that supporting health issues in other countries, or poverty or hunger or whatever it is, they actually think that's a good thing, but they just haven't prioritised it. And that persuadable middle, depending which country you're in, they're quite often swing voters. So they're not necessarily, and that's a rapidly changing picture depending on what country you're in as well. But you know, basically they're not particularly tied. They're centre-right, centre-left. And then if they're swing voters, that makes them really influential politically, because the politicians need to talk to them.
Cleo, Twan?
Yeah, I think on messaging and audience, I do understand the definitely the need to cater messaging to a particular audience. And Liz was mentioning, we already have our allies, and in many ways, we do not want to just preach to the converted. We also want to reach the movable middle. And in some ways even move some of those who, in my case, for example, I would refer to them as right-leaning or conservative. There are many of those on that end of the political spectrum who could be moved and could have their views changed or reshaped. And I think this idea that perhaps even that we're all on a flat scale and you move from left to right perhaps needs to be reassessed, that it's a lot more complicated and complex than that. But at the same time, what I've seen with the movement to free Palestine around the world and really showcase the genocide happening in Gaza is activists have not softened their language or taken a more gentle approach when using their terminology. And despite the world's media's efforts to discredit and hide the real impact that these activists are having in their communities and really changing and shaping people's opinions and changing people's minds, that the movement is growing. You know, that despite people's hard line on language and political beliefs, that thousands of people are gathering in The Hague, to free Palestine. Thousands of people are gathering, or millions of people are gathering across the world, in the US, in you know, across Europe, across Africa, to free Palestine. So I think it is really important to be mindful of our communication and language, depending on audience. But there are also plenty of examples where maintaining a hard line can work, so long as there is a strong conscientization effort behind it, like a really strong emphasis on popular education and political education. How do we get people there? It's not necessarily only about using language that can meet them where they're at, but also creating opportunities to learn to get them where we're at, or to find a way to for us all to meet in the middle.
I think this is such an important point. Like, the this is exactly that tension, right? So I think I mentioned this earlier. That's this tension between where we want to go and where we are now. And obviously, a lot of the research data points will be over-indexing on the where we are now. I think it's about that, but that doesn't mean that the data doesn't get us anywhere. I think what we can see in the data is that there are some things that maybe correlate with persuadability, or these are the types of arguments that people respond positively to, and that potentially can mean they can move closer to exactly where kind of policy asks are on the kind of activist side. So again, those are like things being kind of human-centered, concrete, pragmatic, but sometimes also, you know, there are groups that respond better to the kind of moral frame that Liz mentioned earlier. So then again, yeah, we don't want to segment this into 60 million different audiences, but we do know that there are clusters of people that, especially in the world of social media, also move within networks, right? It's not like every single South African has an equal chance of talking to every other single South African. There are clusters and parts of that network that interact more. So it being able within the context of South Africa, just as an example, to separate out those networks and say, okay, this message will work for that network, that message will work for that network, I think strikes a nice middle ground between not having one message for everyone, but also not individualizing the messages too much.
And the other thing I'm hearing from this is also that different messages and different audiences are seeking different outcomes. And that's okay, right? I think with the examples Khalil was giving, and yourselves, Liz and Antoine as well, some of the stuff you're talking about is, it's not that we don't want to speak to our allies. It's that the things we're trying to get our allies to do that are already on side are quite different to what we're trying to get the middle to do. So, you know, the goal isn't necessarily to get the middle to join a 100,000 person march, but maybe need to make a different political decision when an election comes around, or to maybe donate or change their specific behavior. So maybe they should start spending money on a better source of news, like, you know, start licensing a newspaper that's or subscribing to a newspaper that's actually giving good quality information, so that you resource that good quality information getting spread more broadly. And that outcome we're seeking per audience is also how we change the message, which I think leads very nicely into sort of the last question I want to ask as we're looking to wrap this conversation up, which is, I suppose, two things. One, what do you want people to take away from this research? And could be different audiences or just the main audience that you were thinking of. And the second thing is, what do you want people to take away from the conversation we've had today? I'm going to start with Tuan. And then if we can go to Khalil and then Liz.
So I think I'll start on an optimistic note, really, which is that I think we're not starting from scratch here at all. I think for a complicated topic like debt, there is a certain advantage in certain technical details not already having been kind of politicized in many audiences across the world. So in a way, there's room for mobilization, and a lot of the issues that are actually being spoken about feels like the kind of people's views or citizens' views are quite close to a lot of the policy asks, which is not the case for every political issue, right? So I think that's really a good thing about the issue of debt. The challenge, of course, maintains kind of making it a higher priority and everything. But the fact that debt as an issue perhaps is quite suitable for this type of campaigning, I think makes it really kind of fertile ground for campaigners. And hopefully that's a bit of an optimistic message to start out with.
Thanks, Juan. Khalil?
I think my parting words on this would be that debt is a really intentionally mystified issue, and the best way to kind of cut through all of the smoke and mirrors around it is to reach people where they're at, either through messaging or through popular education, and that this is all an ongoing process. And I think the learnings that Liz and Tuan have been sharing here can be applied not just to debt justice campaigning work, but also climate or economic or gender-based justice work, or the work we do in the LGBTQI community. You know, that these learnings are applicable everywhere, that really it's all about reaching people where they're at and taking them on a learning journey. I think that's what I would like the listener to really leave this session with.
Thanks, Khalil. And Liz?
Yeah, so I'm probably echoing Khalil, really. So I think, you know, whoever your audience is, start where they are and have a conversation. Don't just tell them what you think don't tell them what you're desperate to tell them that you think is important. Start with their reality and have the conversation. And then the other thing is, all this research is out there. It's available. It's open source. And as I said earlier, but it's a direction of travel. We now need to put these insights into practice, because when it actually hits real life, the messenger, the creative, all of those things change. And someone will be coming back to me going, actually, Liz, the moral frame did far better than that mutual benefit when we did it in real life. And it all depends, right? This is hopefully food for thought, but we need it to happen in real life. Insight is important, but we actually need to have the comms happening as well.
Thanks so much. I do have one thing, or a few things, I want our listeners and the folks in the audience to do, which is, one, like, subscribe, and all the other wonderful things, and comment, please comment your questions and anything like that in the comments below. But also, please do it for our wonderful guests and the organizations they come from. They've been doing really amazing work. We'll make sure we link it in the description below. And check it out. See if there's anything you want clearer. And it's not work that ends, right? There's going to be more research. There's going to be more content created. And if you have inputs you want to share with us for next time, please drop it below. And thanks for watching, and thanks for joining us, everyone. Cheers.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Thanks for watching this Mobilize podcast. Remember to follow, subscribe, like, and comment.